I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab, and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
I've been everywhere. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, going out live to 26 AM FM stations worldwide. Big shout out to our listeners in the US of New Madrid Fault Line, or the former USSA, as I've come to call it. And on the line here, we have another Kiwi collaborator for you, ladies and gentlemen. It's my esteemed pleasure, an honour, in fact, to welcome Nando Tanchos, a former member for the Green Party in Parliament. Nando, are you on the line with us?
Yeah, greetings.
Hey, welcome to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, mate.
Thank you.
If you could just please give everybody a little bit of a recap about yourself, because we have a foreign audience in a large capacity, and they may not be familiar with who you are, mate.
I'm just thinking of that, the almighty saying about the kumara doesn't boast of its own sweetness. I've been an activist pretty much all my life, ever since I discovered the Sex Pistols and heard the word anarchy, decided to find out what that was, and been involved in various grassroots movements my whole life. I lived in England for a while and was involved in the Stonehenge festivals and the Peace Convoy, the anti-miner strike where Margaret Thatcher was hammering into the, trying to destroy the mine workers' unions. And here came back to Aotearoa and have been involved in, again, quite a few different things here. Spent a long time involved in cannabis law reform and drug law reform, as one of the, what I think is one of the cutting edges of the civil rights issues, and what we have is an incorrect balance between the power of the state and the rights of individuals. So that's something I've been interested in for a long time. Involved in the anti-GE movement, and then in 1999 I joined the Green Party. Well, I joined a couple of years earlier, but in 1999 I was elected as a Green MP, an MP for the Green Party here in New Zealand. First Rastafarian in the world to be elected to a parliament, as far as I understand. And probably my main issues there, again, drug law reform, but also constitutional change, justice and civil rights, and open source software is something I'm interested in too. So I've got a fairly eclectic range of interests.
Well, you know, and I've seen a couple of interviews with you, Nando, and the interesting thing I find about you is that it is not a specific base of knowledge that you come from. It is a broad spectrum of experience, knowledge, and what I would call an expertise in the understanding of complex systems and how the government and indeed the world works, which is why I kind of wanted to invite you on the show, because in my opinion, we've got a very, very, very bad system in every sector of society at the moment. You know, the healthcare, government elections, civil rights, the economy. Everything seems to be going quite fairly awry in a lot of cases. And what a lot of people are saying now is that, look, the core issue here is the banking system, the international finance leaders, World Bank, IMF, are inflating all our currencies, and the big banks and Wall Street are making up all these big derivative bubbles, and essentially they've created so much debt out of a computer that the global economy will never recover. And this is something that is currently affecting everybody. I mean, the of course, our government, what was it, according to BNZ, we're now borrowing $450 million a week to stay afloat. You know, and it's just difficult to comprehend. I wanted to know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are very important. I mean, you know, and thank you for your kind words earlier as well. And I mean, I guess for me, I look at the challenges that we face in the world today, and they're immense. You know, we've got the. You're quite right when you talk about the financial institutions and the way that the fetters have been let off the kind of financial trading sector. And that was quite a deliberate move and has created horrendous side effects. While some people have got extremely wealthy, and we've seen the gap between rich and poor increase in countries like New Zealand, and I believe it's the same in the United States and places like England as well. But to me, that's one issue. You know, there are other issues which are equally important and urgent, and of course we face the issue of climate change. Which is gathering pace. We face the issue of peak oil, the reality that we're coming to the end of cheap oil, and our whole civilization, if you want to call it that, is built on cheap fossil fuels. And when we come to the end of those, you know, that creates real problems. And of course, there's some people who'd say that the great recession that we've just been experiencing, and it's questionable whether we're coming out of it or not, but that's as well as the whole issue with subprime mortgages and derivative trading and all these things. That one of the big issues there was actually the price of oil. That when the price of oil went up, due to this kind of you know, we've got this growth, or we're starting to hit the gap between the demand and supply. When the price of oil goes up, it means people are unable to pay off those loans that that have been so easily and cheaply available, and that's what actually brought the whole. Deck of, you know, the whole house of cards, I should say, coming down. So yes, I think those financial issues are extremely important, but they go hand in hand with an ecological crisis, which in some ways is more fundamental. And underlying it, in my view, is a psychological problem that in the kind of the philosophy that's driven Western industrial society is no longer, if it ever was, but it certainly is no longer functional in the world that we live in. In that, you know, we have to start to understand ourselves as part of nature, not separate from nature. We have to see ourselves as part of the web of life, and we have to take our place humbly and appropriately among the web of life that we're part of. Because the capitalist system, yes, it is driving not just this kind of financial meltdown, but it's also driving ecological degradation, because it's built on a model that says that growth is good at all costs. Growth is the only measure of economic well-being, according to the way we currently do things. And so therefore, you know, growth is good, more growth is better. And of course, you can't have unlimited growth on a finite planet. So there's a fundamental conflict between this kind of economic system that we invented. It's a figment of our own collective imagination, and is coming hard up against the physical realities of the planet that we actually live on. So I would say, like, climate change, peak oil, financial meltdown are all symptoms of a deeper problem, which is and that manifests particularly in this kind of capitalist economic system that we're part of now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I have some disagreements with you there. I mean, I would debate whether or not it's actually capitalism. I don't think what we have is a free market at all whatsoever. If anything, it's just a gangster market occupied essentially and controlled by very few players. You know, the large financial banking institutions, they have essentially formed a cartel over global finance, and now the world is starting to wake up and sort of realize the hold that these very few large players actually have, and more to the point, the enormous hole that they're creating for everybody. And the economic instruments of our time is basically oil, you know. Conveniently, it's the second most abundant liquid on Earth after water. And apparently, the Russians have been doing deep core drilling since the 70s to find these enormous reservoirs of oil, and discoveries are happening now all over the world, where they've unearthed trillions and trillions of barrels, in particular reserves. I believe the Gulf of Mexico, where this big oil canic eruption happened, was the discovery of one such reservoir that ran from the Gulf of Mexico up until midway through northern Canada. It was that large. So the peak oil thing, I'm sort of wondering that now, because if we're discovering far more reserves than we've ever found before, how can there literally be that much plant material or anything that's actually, you know, come back and done that? And on top of that, we have wells in Texas. You remember during the oil price shocks of the 70s that had dried up. And now they're full of oil again. They just turned the pumps back on after leaving them dry for a decade or two. It's like, what? There's something really bad going on.
I mean, my understanding is that America's policy on oil has been to reserve its own. Like when Hubbard predicted the peak oil in the continental USA, and he did it accurately as well. My understanding is when that actually registered, that the American policy has been to hold on to their reserves and to use up everyone else's oil. And so now we see with the price of oil going up because of the unrest in the Middle East, we're seeing America now starting to tap into, you know, make some of those reserves available again. And it's the same policy on rare earth metals. You know, we have 97% of the world's rare earth metals come from China, but they only hold about 30 or 40% of the world's reserves. It's just that it's extremely toxic to do, so we let them do it. And also it's a way of we can use up all their rare earth metals, and in the case of the States, which has quite a few reserves, they can hold on to their own as a strategic advantage. And my view, that's what they've been doing with oil. But in terms of these massive new reserves that are coming online, well, I haven't seen any evidence of that, and I guess I'll reserve judgment until I actually see it happening, because I've heard a lot of different ideas about wonderful new sources of energy, and I haven't seen any of them bear out yet, so I'll wait and see.
Okay. Well, that's cool. At least you'll have a look at it. you know, because most people then just kind of flat deny and refuse to look. You know, that sort of, I presume that you've had that during the course of your political career, that when you're talking sense and you've got facts and evidence, and people will just, you know, hit you with this wall of no, like cannabis law reform, for example. It's freaking hilarious.
I think on most issues, probably a lot of people make up their mind on an emotional basis, and then they look for the evidence to justify their point of view. And I see that happen all the time. And I guess the thing is, as activists or as human beings, I think we have to go beyond that, and we have to. I mean, sure, we all. I think, you know, I mean, I look at myself. The positions I take start from an emotional reaction to the world around me. I see a lot of injustice, and I see a lot of unnecessary environmental degradation going on. So my response is emotional. But then in looking at the evidence, I like to think that I'm open to evidence that counters my own point of view, and I'd like to think that at least some other people are the same as well. Because I think, the reality is, if we're not actually open to our opponents' points of views, then we're never going to learn anything. And that's one of the things that I think. One of the criticisms I'd make of the kind of progressive movement in general, if I can term it that way, and by which I kind of encompass kind of green politics and left politics and different kinds of what I'd call progressive politics. One of the difficulties that we face is that we can be a bit kind of self-righteous and think we have all the answers, and we actually diminish our own understanding by doing that, and we weaken our own position as well.
I completely and utterly agree with you, Nandor, and that's exactly what we need to hear now, you know, from politicians and from activists and things like that, is the willingness to listen to your opposition with an open mind and just, like, base it, weigh it up with the evidence. Because one thing that I've noticed in particular, being a paid member of Greenpeace for a while, was that now a lot of our Greenpeace activists who are going out and talking about climate change, you know, they're basically just these foreigners who have come in from overseas and don't know anything about climate change. Haven't even heard about the IPCC, and they're trying to encourage people to go to the Sign On campaign. And then when you try and tell them about how carbon trading is actually really bad, how it's another bad financial instrument, that you get totally demonized. They accuse you of being from an oil company and things like that. And it's like, no, it's not what I'm saying. I'm saying we don't want to give the bad guys any more tools.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Nandor Tanchos, coming in live from New Zealand. Check us out on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com with the archives there. We'll be right back after this very short break.
Oh, yeah. Tonight we're gonna make love. You know how I know? Because it's Wednesday, and Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love. It's because it's when everything is just right. There's nothing good on TV. You haven't had your social netball team practice, so you're not too tired. Oh, yeah. Sounds like it's all on. You say something to me like, I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning. But I know what you mean. You mean, oh yeah, it's business time, it's business time.
It's business, it's business time.
That's what you mean it's business time. Oh.
It's business, it's business time.
Oh yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's business time on the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in collaboration with GuerrillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's unconventional news. My marvellous special guest is Nandor Tanchos, live from New Zealand. Nandor, welcome back.
Thanks, Vinny.
Okay, that's all good. Let's not get too emotional here. Hey, one thing I wanted to know from you, mate. Parliament itself is having a bit of a protest on May the 1st, the Idiots in Power protest. And one thing I wanted to talk about with you is this false left-right dichotomy position where we look at National Party policy, Labour policy, and find out that for all intents and purposes, they're virtually identical. They don't propose a radically different systems. You know, it's almost like there's no real difference between the right and the left anymore. You know, they've become centrist, so that the voting blocks of people out there will inevitably always wind up voting for a government that won't bring any different kind of government into the play. You know.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, you know, the whole notion of left and right's kind of, in terms of parliamentary parties, was redefined when the fourth Labour government came in 1984 and basically unleashed a neoliberal revolution on the New Zealand economy and policies. And so then National was left with a thing of, do they try and outright Labour? But that was extremely difficult because they were so kind of new right. And then so National tried to jump over them that way, and then Labour kind of came back in 1999. But basically, both parties have now decided that the best way to power is to congregate around the middle and try and outbland each other as much as possible, and just do, you know, try and kind of do nothing that offends anyone or upsets anyone, and try and keep it all last common denominator kind of stuff. And you're quite right; that leaves us with virtually no choice. It's a choice of style. Now, do you want a man or a woman? Do you like his suit or do you like his suit? Or, you know, that's kind of, well, except that, you know, that's kind of the image that's presented to the citizenship. But on the other hand, I mean, I do think that with the National Party that's currently in, you know, well, we've seen them start to reveal that their agenda of privatisation of a few remaining kind of state assets that we have, and these kinds of things, which I don't think Labor would do. So there is some difference, but their difference is on the economic fundamentals and the social fundamentals. They're pretty much the same. And that's a real problem. And so in New Zealand, we're hearing talk of, you know, will we see a new left party start up? And there was a lot of speculation when Māori Party MP Hone Harawira left the Māori Party about whether he would kind of be part of starting up a new left party with people like Matt McCartan and people like that.
Sue Bradford.
And the interesting thing was, you know, because with the New Zealand system, I mean, for the American listeners, I kind of feel sorry for you guys because your electoral system basically means that you don't get any kind of minority representation. In New Zealand, we've moved to a proportional representation system, which is a lot fairer because it means you do start to get Green Party and other kind of smaller voices represented in the legislature.
Unfortunately, the same type of bollocks goes on in Parliament as it does in the United States. Isn't that true, though? I mean, it's like the United States and New Zealand, I find, are very comparable in a lot of ways, you know? We each get very wealthy, very evil people elected to rule the country.
I think that's true, but I think MMP moderates that. As you know, as I said, you no longer have, like, two block. You know, it's not Labor versus National or Republicans versus Democrats as it would be in the States. With MMP or with any kind of proportional representation, you start getting other voices. So it's not two power blocks. They're broken up. And that means that, say, National now is in power, but to get legislation through, they don't have a majority in Parliament, and so they have to make coalitions and they have to do negotiation and they have to start to listen to some of the other voices. Now, some of those other voices I don't like, but nevertheless, it does mean that they have to listen to other parties. And so I think it kind of breaks up the kind of duopoly power thing that goes on. And I think also in New Zealand, and probably partly because we're smaller and less powerful, that I don't think you're seeing the same kind of big money involved. You know, election campaigns are largely run on quite a lot of money. But if you look at the electoral expenses of the Green Party, it's actually quite small. So, you know, you're now at a position where you can start to get some representation in without having to have massive corporate funders. Now, when I say some representation, that doesn't mean that the Greens or anyone like that runs the government. But what it does mean is that there's a Green voice in there, and the Greens, under certain circumstances, get to have some influence. So I think it's better. I think PRs are, you know, I definitely encourage anyone who's got a kind of first past the post system to try and get themselves a PR system, because it makes a huge difference in terms of what gets represented.
Indeed. Representation is decent. Thanks, Nandor, for coming on, bro. Really appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks, Vinny. Good to talk to you, bro.
Oh, man. Fabulous. Any final words for our listeners there, mate? Oh, well, he seems to have gone.
advert for the Constitution. I was just been reading this book called 1491 by Charles Mann, and he puts up a theory that the American Constitution was significantly based on the Constitution of the Haudenosaunee, who is an alliance of northeastern Indian tribes. It's quite interesting because I hadn't been aware of that, but it's a good book for your American listeners to read. 1491, the true history of America before white people got there.
Cool, man. Thanks very much. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show, and we'll be back tomorrow. We're here today with Nandor Tanchos, a former Green Party member and a fairly awesome all-round researching dude. Nandor, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinny.
Oh, right. Hey, well, one thing we wanted to get into, we got cut off on the show this afternoon, was the ETS debate. I want to know what your perspective is on this.
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting thing because I don't really have a fixed view on what the best way to deal with carbon is. I think you've got to put it, like, within the context of the economy that we got now, which I think needs to be fundamentally restructured. But within the economy that we have now, as a first step, I think you've got to put a price on carbon. You've got to make businesses say, when they're making their business decisions, that it's going to cost them to put this pollution into the atmosphere, rather than currently they just get away and do it for free. There's two ways you can do it, right? Two main ways, or the two main paths that I'm aware of is, one is having an emission trading scheme and the other one is having a carbon tax. And there's pros and cons of both sides. In New Zealand, we're implementing an emission trading scheme, and I think there's good arguments for an emission trading scheme. If you have a properly designed emission trading scheme, what you can do is you can say, this is the absolute level of emissions that we're going to allow into the atmosphere from this country. So you can put an absolute cap on, and in fact, what you have is you have a sinking cap. So you say, we're going to start off at this level now, and over the next 10 years, we're going to reduce it by a set amount each year, right? And then you go, we don't know what it's going to cost to kind of get rid of carbon. So we're going to let the market work out the price. They can trade the emission permits among themselves, but we set the limit. The key thing is, in my view, if you've got an emission trading scheme of some kind or a permit scheme, you've got to have a tight lid. As I said, it's got to sink each year, and you can't give away free permits. Everyone's got to pay for their own permits, because otherwise what happens is some people get free permits, and then that's now a tradable commodity. They can make money just by trading a permit that they got for free. So it's like giving cash to big industrial polluters, many of whom can reduce their emissions quite easily, but they've never bothered to do that. Now that the pressure's on, if I can reduce my emissions by so many tons of carbon, and now those extra permits that I've now got, I'll just sell them and make money off them, which is exactly what's going on. So I think that the emission trading scheme is a good idea if it's done properly with a tight cap that sinks and no free permits. The problem is that when you introduce an emission trading scheme, there's all these opportunities for big business to lobby for free credits, which is, of course, what they've done in this country. So our biggest greenhouse gas emitter is pastoral farming. They've managed to get themselves a free ride for X number of years. Our other big industrial emitters, like the cement industry, have got themselves free permits. So all the big business people have managed to get special favours, and they got all these free permits, which are now just money in the bank for them. So that's the problem with emission trading, is politically it's hard to put in place one that actually sticks. And as a result, what you end up is giving a subsidy to the rich. Because in this country, what's happened is all the big emitters don't have to pay for their emissions, and the people who end up having to pay is just ordinary people who've got to pay extra for their petrol and their power, whatever. So ordinary people end up paying the bill for the big business people. It's another subsidy for corporates.
Mm. Well, that's exactly what my friend Will says. He says that when it comes to emissions trading schemes, it's not holding the corporations responsible, it's holding the taxpayers responsible.
Exactly. And that's the problem with the way we've done it in this country. The other alternative is a carbon tax. Now, politically, it's much easier to do fairly, because you just go, we put a carbon tax on, everyone pays it, end of story. So politically, it's simpler. The difficulty with a carbon tax is you can set the price of the carbon, but you don't know how much the emissions are going to go down, because that all depends on how much it costs to reduce emissions. So you can go, okay, we're going to make it $50 a ton, and if a business goes, well, it costs me $60 a ton to reduce my carbon emissions, I'd rather just pay the tax. So you end up getting money in, you know how much money's going to come in. It tends to be fairer because it's easier to put in place, but you don't know how much the emissions are going to reduce. Those are the two pros and cons of the system. With the emissions trading scheme, you know how much the emissions are going to come down, but it's politically more difficult to distribute it fairly. With a tax, it's easier politically, but you don't know what emissions you're going to reduce. So that's the challenge for policymakers, eh?
Well, when I see a challenge for policymakers, I feel that the main policy differential is when somebody offers you A or B, a politician's best answer is what's C. And this is the thing. Those two choices between carbon tax or emissions trading scheme are both financial instruments. And in my experience, looking at the financial sector, it means that essentially what you're doing is you're opening up the door for those big businesses and those financial interests to get their hands on an economy, really. The concept of state capture is when large influencers get into parliament at policy level. And I think that that's precisely
what's happening right now.
Well, exactly, and this is the danger. We've already given these corporates all this power. We've already given them the ability to take away our rights, you know. And essentially what they're doing is it's just natural progression. This is our rights, and they're going down. And there seems to be no stop. Like it's like a landslide of civil disorder that's being done on purpose so that we can be extracted, essentially, you know. And this is what I believe is going on with all the mining and the national parks and the search and surveillance bill. All of these things are connected, I believe, and I think that there is nothing really in it when we talk about climate change. One thing, personally, I'm technically a climate denier, right? But my theory is that even if it was a real thing, the correct way to go about it would not be to use financial instruments. And you offered the choice of carbon tax or emissions trading. My false dichotomy is those versus grassroots action, you know, like building resilient communities, getting people on track with more sustainable living just in their own right, you know, their own learning how to garden. For example, seems to be the most important thing for everybody, because food prices are going absolutely astronomically out of this world, and any type of carbon trading or emissions trading scheme would only exacerbate the situation. And we have people suffering all over the place now, and I think that this anything extra to reduce people's independence, whether that be the ability to survive on their meagre income or the ability to survive on stuff that they can grow themselves in a more independent fashion, is very important for everybody to look at.
Yeah, I mean, can I say I completely agree with you, and I think one of the problems with the whole climate change debate is it's been a debate that's held at an elite level among political and business elites, and ordinary people have been left out. Oh, it's too technical. You guys won't understand, so we won't bother to engage you. And I think you're quite right that we actually do need to engage ordinary people in a discussion, both about what is going on and also what are the adaptive strategies. And, you know, and the kind of things you talked about are exactly right. And I guess I'd say my caution would be that I think there's a tendency to focus on individual action, which is important. But also, but what interests me probably more and I think is more powerful is collective action at a grassroots level. So it's not just, I mean, yes, grow vegetables in your own backyard, but how do you start to work with other people in your neighbourhood to create a resilient community? Because security has to be collective. You can't, you know, you can't do these things on your own. We're social beings. That's how we've always been. So that kind of collective action at a grassroots level, I completely agree with you. But I guess what I'd say is I don't think it's a dichotomy as opposed to the price on carbon stuff, because while the very stuff you talked about is absolutely essential, regardless of anything else that goes on, at the same time, what I'm worried about is if you just do those things, then you still give the corporates a free ride. And so that's why I think you do have to, until we have an overhaul of the economic system, which is something I think is coming, because I don't believe a growth economy is functional within the kind of, now that we're starting to reach the ecological limits of the planet, we have to move to a steady state economy, the kind of stuff Herman Daly and people like that talk about. You know, so yes, we need to restructure the whole economy. But what I'm saying is given what we've got and pending those other changes, I think at least let's make the businesses start to pay for the carbon they emit, so it gives them an incentive to start to reduce their carbon emissions. Because otherwise, what are they going to do? Sure, we can grow our own gardens, but like, what? How's that going to stop wholesome cement pumping out CO2 into the atmosphere? Or how's it going to stop farmers? How's it going to get farmers to reduce their herds? You know, and the thing with farming in this country and internationally, it's not just a climate change issue; it's a water quality issue. It's, you know, one of the biggest environmental polluters is pastoral farming all over the world, and in this country it's particularly true because it's such a major part of the economy. How do we get farmers to stop expanding their herds if we don't start to make them pay for the environmental consequences of what they do?
Well, yeah, and this came up with a term that I coined. It's like New Zealand is a Fonterra estate.
Yeah. Well, that's right. You know, it's and now, I mean, interestingly, Fonterra keeps trying to break, because it's a cooperative at the moment, which gives us some security. They keep trying to break that and try and create tradable shares, which I think adds another level of danger. Because then it's not just farmers, it's also the international speculators coming in and putting new pressure on to increase, you know, the dividend payouts and increase the share price and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, and for my money, I mean, no major corporation ever winds up doing things very well because they base all their operations centrally, and no centrally planned economy has ever really survived very well, I mean, long term. They've all kind of wastage, inefficiency, etc. We talked about the idea of individualism versus collectivism, and again, option C emerges as a combination of both, right? Individual responsibility inside smaller communities, right? Like, for example, the borough council model that we used to run by worked incredibly well at keeping neighbourhoods upkept because one person on every street was exempt from paying their rates, and their job was to just keep an eye on the rest of the street and report to their local council. It worked very well. And that's because there was such a spreading out of the responsibilities. When all of those are centralized, whether it be production or decision making, it always drifts far apart from the true needs of the community at the ground level, where the support needs to be coming from.
Yeah. Look, I'm very with you on that. I mean, one of the things that interests me particularly in the New Zealand context is constitutional change, because we're in a process of constitutional change. And so the question is, where does that go? You know, we're discussing the Treaty of Waitangi, and our relationship with Indigenous people. We're discussing republicanism. We've just moved to set up our own Supreme Court, all these kinds of things. And one of the things that I'm interested in is a decentralisation of power, because in New Zealand, and I think it's common to, well, actually, no, I won't. Certainly in New Zealand, we have a very centralised notion of political power. We have the Crown is the sovereign. The Crown is the source of all justice, all sovereignty. And Parliament kind of enacts laws on the Crown's behalf or recommends legislation for the Crown, who signs it off in a formal sense. And our local councils are a construct of Parliament. So if you look at what happened in Christchurch, the regional council was starting to try and put limits on the expansion of dairy farming because it's completely destroying the river systems, the fragile, unique, braided river systems of Canterbury. The regional council, there was a political discussion between the farming lobby and the other people in the regional council. And when it looked like there was going to be some limits on the farmers, the government stepped in, sacked the regional council, and put in an appointed body to run the regional council.
Headed by Dame Margaret Baisley.
Destroyed, I mean, democracy out the window. These are the people that the local people elected. Democracy out the window. And they can do that because local councils have no inherent sovereignty or jurisdiction of their own. They're created by acts of parliament in this country. And one of the things that I'm really interested in at the moment, I've been reading Murray Bookchin, who coined the term social ecology. And he's got some very interesting ideas about radical municipalism, moving to a decentralized local body kind of size structure and with radical citizenship, where people engage in their local communities, engage in the politics, and then start to federate, because we do need to make national decisions, you know. And what we're seeing in the world is we're going in the opposite direction. We're increasingly centralized. We've got increasingly moving towards regional political bodies, global political bodies. Now, I don't think that's necessarily an entirely bad thing. I think some decisions should be made globally. Some decisions should be made at a regional, say, Pacific Asia basis, some at a national basis, some at a provincial basis, some at a suburb or small town basis. And the thing for me is deconstructing this idea of sovereignty and saying, what are the kind of decisions which are best made at the local level? What are the kind of decisions which are best made at a global level and wherever? And working it out that way on a functional basis. But at the moment, what we say is, and it's a very recent invention, the nation state is the sovereign power. That's the default kind of sovereign. And then they can either kind of work together on a global basis or can devolve some power to locally, you know.
Well, and again, I mean, we're experiencing this sort of, it's actually, I'm going to call it like it is. It's a fucking fascist takeover of all national sovereignty. That's what's happening. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right, we've got the corporates coming in. Like Mussolini said, you know, if you want to correctly term fascism, you call it corporatism, because that's what happens when the state takes gets taken over by the corporations. And now we've got all these economic partnerships, you know, TPP, and all the ones that happened in the United States, you know, and basically every single time that anybody signs one of these free trade deals, their economy gets shot to hell. It destroys everything. The EU is destroyed. The United States is destroyed. And everybody everywhere is now saying, oh, how great these free trade deals are. Yeah. Let's get one too. Even though every single person that you could ever look at as an expert, as evidentiary, a conclusion on how bad these are for your economy, they're all in agreement. It ifs you down to the rabbit hole in a place of which your craziness will never stop. Right? And people are so freaking stupid and misinformed in this country, and not just this country, mind you, about the state of affairs here. We're dealing with a corporate takeover of planet Earth. And this is why I get so uppity about it, because I think, you know, holy cow, man, everything's being taken over. Does that mean we're under attack? Does that mean we have to fight back? And if we do have to fight back, what kind of weapons are we allowed to use? Because they're you can't just walk up to a police officer and shoot a police officer, can you? You know, you can't do that, because that's murder. But if a police officer kicks in your door because you're growing a few plants and shoots you because you're reaching for a double shot bong, you know, that's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
So we have this disparity now between what's controlling us and the control that we have over our own lives. And I don't know how to solve this problem, quite frankly. I think that it is maybe information, just getting the information out there, get these discussions started. Because during the Nazi takeovers and whatever takeover you want to talk about, it was propaganda campaigns that brainwashed the public into believing things that weren't good for them were good for them. You know, eugenics and all of these, and this is the same phenomenon, you know, history repeating itself. We're living in frickin' 1937, 1939 Nazi Germany right now. Now, but they didn't have the internet. They don't have international talk shows like from New Zealand sort of thing, you know, to talk to those people there. This is a wild card, I think. And this is where a lot of my argument against the idea of collectivism comes in, because it's always been individuals who will lead large collectives into it. So essentially, the power of the individual is the wild card in a collective format. So it almost trumps it to a certain extent. You know, take Hugo Chavez or Gandhi or say anybody. You know, anybody who's ever led a decent revolution of any sort has basically come into that fold because they have that desire to serve the collective. It's interesting, the relationship between it. It's not mutually exclusive. There's the individual's need to serve the collective and the collective's need to serve itself working here.
Mm.
So whom...
It's not the only model of revolution. I mean, you look at Republican Spain... You know, and that was based on many, many decades of anarchist organizing to so people became their own leaders. And the Spanish Revolution was, you know, you can't point to a leader who fought the fascists in Spain in the 30s. You know, you can't point to a leader actually who overturned the Russian Tsar. You can point to leaders who co-opted the revolution. You can point to Lenin and Trotsky and the people who actually took over after it had happened and brought in their own secret police and all the rest of it. But the actual revolution itself was a people's uprising. So I don't entirely agree with you, but I do agree that in that a lot of things, what you see is that people who are in touch with the time and are kind of in touch with the collective sense of what's possible and people's desire of where they want to go can, by kind of embodying the vision of it, can help to bring it to reality, because they give expression and then people go, yes, that's what I think, and they get in behind. So yeah, I agree, there's a kind of a dialectic between individualism and collectivism, for sure.
It's
ideally we should all be leaders, you know, we should all individually be express and recognise our own sovereignty and our own ability to be powerful, and then we join together, and that's when it happens for us.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's the power that the government can't take off people, is that individual will. You know, they don't care what you're telling me to do. I will do it anyway. You know, I mean, cannabis is a prime example. We have like what, one in eight maybe cannabis users in this country, despite the fact that it's illegal. You know, I mean, obviously telling people to do something doesn't work very well unless they agree with you. So then again, here comes that that concept of propaganda and coercing conformity with force and manipulating people's minds with sophisticated media programming techniques. Okay, I mean, like depression, for example, very very like a misnomer in this country in terms of what needs to be done about it. What needs to be done about it is you've got to stop drinking Coca-Cola, eating pies, drinking beer, and go out there and get some frickin' exercise and get some nice green and colourful fruits and vegetables into your body so that you have the nutritional resources to make sure you don't go frickin' nuts every day.
Yeah. Well, and there's another thing I'd add to that, yeah, is and become politically active. Because yeah, if you look at the world around you, no wonder you're fucking depressed. If you're doing something about it, maybe you'd feel a bit better.
Yeah, hey, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we've been instilled with this apathy, and apathy depresses people. So no wonder. You know, it's bloody cause and effect. Get off your bums, people. Do something about it, because you are the individual with the power. And this radio show is trying to brainwash you into thinking that you're a powerful, capable individual that has nothing capable of standing in your effing way. All right. All right, Nandor, if you've got any final statements, you know, like some words of wisdom of surviving through these tough, depressing times, go right ahead, mate.
Oh, well, you know, look, I don't know about that, but I do think that we have to rebuild a culture of activism, because you're quite right, you know, our power and our sense of the ability to take control of our own destiny, it's like it's been taken, sucked away from us. And it's so easy, because it's so convenient to go along with everything and just, you know, we can, you know, everything, we can just trust them because they run things and they're much more clever than I am. And so it must be all good. And, you know, and for most of us in the Western world, you know, it is all good in a sense, because we've got all the toys, we got all the comforts of life. You know, we don't have to face the real issues that people in some other parts of the world have to face. And we, you know, and it's like we live this very privileged existence on the back of poor people globally. But, you know, we live this very privileged existence, and we've got a lot to lose in a material sense. And so people, no wonder people go along, you know, but so we have to kind of rebuild a culture of activism. And also it's recognizing that, you know, that it's a false promise that a new PlayStation doesn't make you happy. A new car doesn't make you happy. You know, what is it that makes you happy? It's your connection with other people. It's your ability to express yourself as a complete human being, you know, and to live in a world where actually it doesn't feel shit to look around. You look around and actually it looks a bit fair, and, you know, it's kind of nice, and there's a bit of nature around, and, you know, we're not destroying species at, like, you know, like this.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
All right. On the subject of getting away from depression. Well, you know, and it's just the thing. You've got to laugh about all of this stuff, man, because if you don't laugh, you will go insane. And I believe that it is a sense of humor that will keep somebody alive through dark times even greater than a sense of belief in God. All right. Thanks.
Anyway, this too shall pass.
This too shall pass. You know, it's all a revolving door, you know. Bad times will come again, as will good times. So you don't need to worry about it, because there's only really one moment, and it's this one, and it's lasted for all eternity, and you'll always experience everything with everybody else throughout history. All right. Thanks, mate.
Thanks, Vinny.